All right, we're ready for Luke 18 and 19. We have visitors with us. We're glad you're here. And just a little note for, and people are tuning in on YouTube all of the time, listening to our classes. So just a little explanation of why we're taking such a large chunk, chapters 18 and 19. We're in a five-year Bible survey. It takes us 5 years to get through the entire Bible. And this is the first year. And so in doing that, we have to take some large segments at times, like chapters 18 and 19, because we have 24 chapters in Luke, and we're trying to do that in 17 weeks. So a little note on that, and then but that's kind of what we're doing here. So we're ready for chapters 18 and 19. This is the outline we're following, borrowing that from Baxter, and we're going to go from one section to the other. Meaning we're going to flag this and mark some passages, if we haven't already marked them in a moment, on the Perean ministry, which is what section 3 is about, the journey to Jerusalem, starting at 951, going through, as he has it, 19 and 44. I will drop it off at 27, verse 27, and I'll flag that for you. And then there is the final tragedy and triumph, as he outlines that, which will carry us to the end of the book. And that's where we're going to be till the book is done. I want to forego our chapter reviews in interest of the amount of material we're going to cover. But I do want to flag this right here. In chapter 17, we're starting in 18 today, we dealt with some things that either dealt with the second coming, we talked about that last time, and I'm not going to go back through all of that, or it's talking about the destruction of Jerusalem, or it's talking about both, and I opt for both. Whatever view you take of that, the same point's going to be that there is judgment coming to those that he is speaking to. And if it's talking about the destruction of Jerusalem, then it's not coming from our vantage point. There is a judgment, but not that one. But to those that he spoke to, there is a judgment coming, either on the nation, and it was, or in the end of time, and it is. Then in light of that, he says some things in chapter 18 having to do with being prepared for the judgment that's coming, ultimately the judgment to come. And so there are three things that are essential. One is faith is essential. And that's what verses 1 to 8 is about. And you say, well, I thought it's dealing with the persistent widow. We'll get to that. But verse 8 is your key, I think, to that it has to do, if you want to be prepared for the second coming, you've got to have the kind of faith that is described in verses 1 to 8. Secondly, there must be humility, as described in verses 9 through 17. That is, the humility like the publican had and like little children have. And then thirdly, you must be willing to sacrifice, like the rich young ruler was not willing to sacrifice. That makes sense? So we're starting with the practical, and then we're going to work back to the text. Often we take the text and come to the practical. But those are the three practical things we're going to learn from this chapter. In light of judgment to come, since it's coming, there are three things that are essential. Faith, humility, and willing to sacrifice. Make sense? All right. Let's get underway here with this chapter. Let's talk about this parable of the persistent widow. This parable is not a comparison from the unjust judge, this wicked judge is described here, to our God, but a contrast between him and our God. That makes sense to you? But let's look at verse 1. He spoke a parable to what end? What was the point of it? Men ought to pray and not lose heart. So here's the point of this parable, and that men ought always to pray and they ought not to lose heart. Well, if you're always praying, then you're not losing heart. If you're losing heart, you're not praying. So either we're always praying or we're losing heart. If we're always praying, we're continually praying. But if we're losing heart, we're growing weary in our praying. Verse 7 indicates that one is praying at all times, like this widow who pled with him how often? Verse 7, day and night, continual. If you lose heart, you're giving up. That's how the New International translates that. Men ought always to pray and not give up. If you're always praying, you're not negligent. If you are losing heart, you're becoming discouraged. William Taylor captured the thought here of what I think this parable is about, and then we'll work through the parable. He's saying it's, don't be discouraged waiting for an answer. Let me preface that by saying, have you ever prayed for something and it seems like it suddenly came to pass? And you're encouraged by that, so you pray again for something and it comes to pass, and you think, wow, this is powerful. And then have you ever prayed for something and it doesn't happen like you prayed, and you pray again and you pray again and you pray again and you pray again and you pray again, and what you've been praying for is not happening? You ever get discouraged thinking, I wonder? Listen to Taylor. He said, but this describes a case of one who's long making requests, that which has not yet been granted, and it encourages him to continue in the presentation of his petition in spite of its apparent uselessness. As Edersheim has said, the word always must not be understood as if it meant continuously, but in the sense of under all circumstances, however apparently adverse, where it seems as if the answer could not come, and we are therefore in danger of fainting and becoming weary. Does that make sense? Is it encouraging praying always? Yes. But is it encouraging praying under all circumstances? Edersheim is right about that. You pray when and you make a request when you see it's about to come to pass, and it does come to pass, and you keep praying. But you keep praying even when it looks like God's not answering your prayer, because that is testimony to your faith. Key word, verse 8. There is a direct connection there. Does that make sense? So let's work through the parable. The parable talks about a certain judge who had no regard for man or for God. In other words, He doesn't respect man, and he doesn't respect the will of God. So therefore, he doesn't care how he treats people. And this widow comes to him, and what does she say? Avenge me, in other words, vindicate me against my adversary. And so defend me and settle the score with my adversary, my enemy. And he said, I won't do it because I don't regard God or I don't regard man. And yet, he says, because she troubles me, I will avenge her, lest by her continual coming she weary me. And so the Lord said, hear what he said. Now here's the contrast. Verse 7, shall not God avenge his own elect who cry out him day and night, though he bears long with him? He's not saying God is like this judge. He's saying God is better than this judge. If an unjust, fearless judge who doesn't care about God or man could give at a continual request, how much more so God, who's a gracious, giving, loving God, give at a continual request. Does that make sense? So, verse 8, that he will avenge him speedily. Nevertheless, when the Son of Man comes, will he really find faith on earth? Let's go to our questions. Question 4, how does faith relate to, how did I word that? To always praying and not losing heart. All right. Faith is demonstrated by the refusal to stop praying. In other words, when the Lord comes, will he still find men who have faith strong enough they're praying, though it doesn't look like at times their requests are being met? Does that make sense? Maybe the answer is being met, but it's just not what you thought it ought to be. You ever pray for something would happen and it doesn't, and later you find out that was a blessing? God was answering that. So will we still have faith enough to keep praying even though it looks like God's not answering our prayers? So in preparation for the second coming, there needs to be faith. What kind of faith? Strong enough, I keep praying daily for the same kinds of things, though it looks like God's not answering my prayer. Make sense? Very good. All right, let's start at verse 9 now through verse 14. Here's the parable of the Pharisee and the publican. This is only recorded here in Luke, by the way. The first parable is as well. And he spoke this to those who, verse 9, here's your key to what this is about. Trusted in themselves that they were righteous and despised others. those who thought highly of themselves, they trust in their own performance before God, and they look down upon others. Case in point, there were two men who went to pray. And one was a Pharisee, and the other was a publican. Now, these men are a lot alike in some ways. They're both Jews. They're both religious. They're both supposed to be in a covenant relationship. Apparently, though some say the publican shouldn't have, they both apparently had some temple privilege because they both went to the temple to pray in this parable, according to Jesus. And they both prayed. But they're different. Notice the prayers. The prayer of the Pharisee that I thank God, what did he say? That I'm not like other men. In other words, I'm better. I'm not an adulterer. I'm not an unjust man. Even as this tax collector, this lowly, worthless tax collector, and I fast twice a week and I give tithes of all that I possess. In other words, he bragged to God about how good he was. And what does the publican say? He beat upon his breast and said, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. And the comment was, the conclusion, verse 14 is, he was more righteous. He went down to his house justified than the other. So here's the difference in the men. One was arrogant, the other was humble. One viewed himself as righteous, the other as a sinner. One felt he was too good to associate with this publican. This publican felt like he was too bad to associate. God be merciful to me. He stood afar off. The Pharisee didn't see any need for mercy. How would I know that? The way he prayed, didn't ask for it. And here's a man who had a great need for mercy. He singles himself out as righteous. He didn't say, God, I'm thankful there are righteous people. I'm thankful that I'm righteous. And the other man singles himself out as a sinner. Remember the second thing required to get ready for the second coming? Humility. That's the point. Now, in connection with that, Jesus, the little children are brought to Jesus 15 to 17. That story is placed in Matthew, seemingly for maybe a different purpose in the context, a contrast. There's not so much a contrast here as it seems to be in Luke's account to attach to this idea of those who trust in themselves. And so he brought little children that he might touch them, apparently to bless them. People are, if they could just lay his hands on them, Matthew's account of that says. And the disciples rebuked, and what did Jesus say about that? No. Go ahead.
He said, let the children come home.
Yeah, let them come. Let them come. For of such is the kingdom of heaven. Now, what he didn't say is that children are in the kingdom. Some have concluded, some of our brethren have argued, that children are saints, children are in the kingdom. It's not what he said. For of such is the kingdom of heaven. In other words, the kingdom of heaven is made up like unto children. What does he mean? Well, look at verse 17. That whoever does not receive the kingdom as a little child will by no means enter it. It's talking about humility in the context. That's how it's used here. That's how it's used in Matthew's account as well. And so that's still a part of this matter and this dose of humility. So if you want to get ready for the second coming, you need humility. You'll never even be in the kingdom. By the way, Matthew 18, Jesus said, except you be converted and become as little children, you shall, know my, shall not even enter the kingdom. Remember that? It was in the context of the disciples saying, who is the greatest? And his point is, if you don't change, you won't even be in the kingdom, let alone have high places in it. Make sense? All right. Now we're moving along. We still have some ground to cover. Let's talk about the rich young ruler. The third thing that we listed a while ago that's essential is being willing to sacrifice. And here was a man who was not. Now Matthew and Mark and Luke all record this story. So let's talk about the rich young ruler. First of all, let's talk about what he was not willing to do. Mark says he come running to Jesus, which indicates to me that he has eagerness. He has an interest in spiritual things. He's eager to come to Jesus. He's eager to ask a question. So he comes running to Jesus, the text says, according to Mark. And what does he ask? He said, good teacher, what good thing shall I do that I might inherit eternal life? And Jesus starts on the note, why do you call me good? Is that a denial that he's good? No. He said, there is none good but God. This is an affirmation of his deity. Exactly. What he's saying is, let's start with who I am. And you call me good, that title belongs to God. But he doesn't refuse the title. But why are you calling? Do you understand who you're talking to? I'm deity. So when deity tells you to do something, when God says do something, you ought to be willing to do that. Well, you'd think, well, let's see. And he said, well, keep the commandments. Well, which ones? And he enumerates, such as don't murder, don't commit adultery, do not steal, do not bear false witness, honor your father and mother. And he said, all of these I've kept from my youth. And preaching on this, I picture sometimes as if we're standing off to the side, watch this young man come running. Are you impressed so far with this young man? I am. He come running. He's got a question about spiritual things. He tells me about his upbringing. From my youth I have kept these. In other words, it's not just a latecomer, but I started in my youth keeping these commandments and doing these. And I've done that from my youth. So he must have had a good upbringing. I'm impressed so far. And he look at verse 22. When Jesus heard these things, he said, you still lack one thing. Matthew's account said that the young man asked that question. So did Jesus call it to his attention, or did he ask the question? The answer is yes. Both. He asked the question and Jesus called it to his attention. Is there anything I lack? And what was Jesus' answer? Yeah, sell everything that you have and give to the poor, and you'll have treasure in heaven. I want to go back to verse 20 just for a moment. Why do you think he obeyed those commands and yet had trouble with this one command that we'll get to in verse 23 in a minute? I've done all the commandments. Yeah. Larry?
I think also putting his trust in God. Our trust should always be in God. No matter what happens, we lean on God. In this situation here, things were tough. He always had his money to lean on. And he knew that. That's what his trust, that's why he said to sell. That's why the emotion that happened was that he lost his foundation.
Yeah, where he's putting his confidence and his trust. Diane?
When Jesus asked him or told him that God is the only one good, he's forcing him to come to the conclusion that either I'm God and you're going to obey me, or you don't fully have that faith that I am God and that what I'm telling you is true. And he agreed. When we do something without faith, it's because we agree with it. Whether in any way that we act. So if we don't murder, we agree murder is wrong, but we may do something else that's convenient for us, and it's because we don't have that faith.
All right, okay, very good point. Yeah, all of those seem to be convenient things. In other words, it wasn't a challenge for him not to murder. It wasn't a challenge for him not to commit adultery. It wasn't a challenge. He could easily keep those. Here is something that's quite difficult, rubs him the wrong way. So verse 23, when he heard that, he went away sorrowful, for he was very rich. He didn't want to part with his riches. Now that leads us to this question of who then can be saved. And so let's talk about that. Jesus said, how hard it is for those who have riches to enter the kingdom of God. Now Matthew and Mark both add something not mentioned here, and that is that the disciples were amazed at that statement. How hard is it for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God? And so Jesus says it's easier for a camel to go through a needle's eye than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God. Two things I want to flag about verse 25. One is that's a literal needle. Some commentators talk about it's a narrow passageway called a needle, and you can get a camel through it, but you get him stuck and you got to push and shove and you finally get him through, and boy, it was difficult, but he can get through there. Jesus is talking about an impossibility. A literal needle. Matthew uses the term for a sewing needle. Luke uses a different term, a suture needle. Why would he use that? He's a physician, yeah. And so God, by inspiration, can use his terminology, his language. And literally, that sewing needle or that suture needle, it would be easier to take a camel and push it through that little eye than for one with the attitude of this man to go to heaven. In other words, it ain't going to happen. It's not going to happen. Now, at verse 27, the things which are impossible with men are possible with God. When they said, well, who then can be saved? What's the point? I think the point there is that the issue rests upon his dependence upon God. Is he willing to obey God? Is he willing to listen to God? And so with God, God doesn't make it hard. It's his greed that makes it hard. With God, it's possible, but with men, it is impossible. Now, notice at verse 28, Peter says, we have forsaken all, and what are we going to get? That's a hireling spirit. Look at the great sacrifice we've made. What are we going to get? Now, by the way, you might make note here in the margin of your text, Matthew 20 adds the parable of the workers of the vineyard here in answer to that hireling spirit. Remember, the first shall be last shall be first. Remember that? Luke doesn't add that. Matthew does. So right here is where that parable fits, if you want to flag that in the margin of your text. So Jesus in 29 and 30 makes two points. Here's what you will receive. You will receive more than you sacrifice. That's the point of verse 29. And you'll receive eternal life. You want to know what you receive? He rebukes him, according to Matthew, for this hireling spirit. But I'll tell you what you want to know the answer to your question. Here it is. You're going to whatever you sacrificed, you're going to get more than you sacrificed. So don't worry about how much you sacrificed. You haven't done such a great sacrifice that you deserve something more. You're going to get more than what you sacrifice. All right. Now let's go to 31 to 34. And by the way, verse 31 is similar to 9 and 51, where he's got his eyes set toward Jerusalem for what that may be worth to you. And he talks about what's going to happen to the Son of Man when he goes to Jerusalem, that as he was going up to Jerusalem, things that are written by the prophets are going to be accomplished. Luke. This is Luke, isn't it? Luke adds something that Matthew and Mark do not mention, and that is that, or that Matthew doesn't mention at least, that he'll be spat upon. Matthew doesn't mention that at all. Now, at verse 34, the disciples didn't understand that. And Mark says they were afraid to ask. Matthew doesn't mention their reaction at all, but Luke mentions that they did not know the things that were spoken. They didn't understand. And so why didn't they ask what it meant? Because they're afraid to ask, according to Mark. I believe that's in 9 and 52. All right. So that gets us through 34. Now there's a blind man that's healed as Jesus was coming near Jericho. Now remember, the Perean ministry is he makes his way from Galilee, came through the region of the border of Samaria and over here in Perea to try to avoid Samaria, we've talked about for obvious reasons, and then make their way down, coming close to Jericho. So as they're coming out of Perea, ignore these lines here, coming toward Jericho, making their way over to Jerusalem, that's where they come in contact with this blind man. So let's flag some things about the blind man. Matthew says there were two blind men, and Luke only mentions one, and Mark only mentions one. Mark says his name was Bartimaeus. Luke and Matthew do not mention the name. So were there two? Yes. There seems to be a predominant one whose name was Bartimaeus. As they make their way, in fact, there's a difference in the account. One account says it was as they were going into Jericho. Another account says as they were coming out of Jericho. And another one says that as they went into Jericho and came out. So which is it? Yes. Alinsky harmonizes that by saying this, that he had come to Jericho and had made his way out of Jericho. That's where he runs into Zacchaeus and makes his way back into Jericho. So it was both going out and coming back in. Make sense? That he had already passed through Jericho, and as he gets out on the outskirts, that's where he runs into Zacchaeus and goes back with him, chapter 19. And that's where he runs into this blind man or blind men and heals him of his blindness. Now, I know there's more to be said about the healing of the blind man, but I want us to move to chapter 19, see if we can cover that now. All right, let's talk about chapter 19. Jesus goes home with Zacchaeus. This is, I take it, he's gone to Jericho, that we've already talked about, made his way past Jericho, just out on the outskirts of the city of Jericho, and that's where he runs into Zacchaeus. What do we know about Zacchaeus? He was a tax collector, despised by other Jews. And he also, because he was short, ran ahead and climbed into the sycamore tree to see if he could get a glimpse of Jesus. He used energy, foresight, determination, etc., trying to see Jesus. And when Jesus sees him, he said, I'll go home with you. I must go home with you. And so he goes back to his house. Now, there's a reason for that. And so what's the reason? I think verse 10 is our key. The Son of Man came to seek and to save that which was lost. He's demonstrated this is the kind of person I came to save. Because there is an uproar and murmuring, verse 7, about him going home with a man who's a sinner. Now this is Jews talking about a fellow Jew. He's going home and spending time with a sinner. And they don't like that. And so Zacchaeus talked about what he had done. I have given half my goods, etc., to the poor. In other words, I'm not the guy they claim I am. But nonetheless, I want to focus at verse 9. Today salvation has come to his house because he's also a son of Abraham. Now maybe you caught this the first time, but on a cursory reading, I didn't catch this. And so I had to go back. What's his point? And I think it's this. The Jews, the Pharisees, argued that a Jew is saved and is in a right relationship with God because he is a Jew. But they're having a fit about Jesus spending time with a publican because he's a sinner. And what Jesus is saying, you think Jews are saved because they're Jews. Hello, this man's a Jew. He is a promise of the son of the promise of Abraham in Genesis 12. You think Jews are saved? This man's a Jew. But this is the kind of man I came to save. You think he's just a wretched sinner. Okay, I come to save this kind of man. Makes sense? Shows their inconsistency, and I came to save. Now, let's talk about the parable of the minas. Your translation may say pounds. Let's get the key to this, because we want to flag two or three things. We've got 10 minutes, so we'll see how far we can get with this. I want to flag several things in this chapter that'll be helpful, I think, for future study. Verse 11 is the key to what this parable is about. This parable is similar to the parable of the talents, but it's not the same. There are differences. It's a different purpose, different goal, different setting. Different story. All right? Look at verse 11. Now, as they heard these things, because they got near to Jerusalem, and because, here's your key, they thought the kingdom of God would appear immediately, he tells them this parable. So what's the point of the parable? It's to offset the expectation of an immediate establishment of the kingdom. They're getting toward Jerusalem. The disciples are thinking, we're going to Jerusalem. I don't get this stuff about him dying and being raised, but we're going there because he's going to establish his kingdom. And Jesus is trying to get them and anyone else to see that's not going to happen here. So what's his story? Well, it talks about the parable of the minas. A mina, if you have a footnote in the New King James, that's about, it had to do with weight of shekels, and it would amount to about 3 months' salary. Caldwell says 4 months' salary. You do with that what you wish. Doesn't matter to me. It's just, it's a small amount. You say, well, that's a lot of money. Small amount in comparison to the talents of Matthew 25. That was a large sum that they were given. But be that as it may, he took 10 servants and said, I'm going away. That's a key verse 12. He's going away to receive a kingdom and he's going to return. So he's saying, the point is, the Son of Man is going away. Jesus is going away and receive his kingdom. Then he's coming back and he's given each one the same amount as in this parable. And when he comes back, he gives an accounting of that. And so one, he said, well, I've gained some with my mina. I took my mina and gained 10 more. And another one says, I gained 5 more with my mina. Each one was given one mina, 1 pound. And another one said, I hid mine. Similar to Matthew 25. And notice he said, I knew you were an austere man. That means a hard and stern man, that you reap where you do not sow. That means, and in interest of time, we don't have time to go to the question. That just simply means that he's expecting fruit. He expected you to take this one and turn it at least to one more. So he's reaping where he didn't sow. And so God does that. Now, so what's the point of that? The point of that is that I'm going away to establish a kingdom, and when I'm coming back, there's going to be an accounting, like he talked about in the first part of chapter 18. Does that make sense? So I'm trying to get you disciples to see and understand, we're not going to Jerusalem. When we get there, we're not about to establish a kingdom, and I'm going to be the earthly king, and we're going to reign here, and I'm going to go away and receive a kingdom. In the meantime, I'm going to have enemies that are out to destroy me and my kingdom, but when I come back, there's going to be an accounting. Does that make sense? So what's the point of this parable? To offset the concept that the kingdom was about to immediately be established. I'm going to go away. And so, well, if you're going away, then we don't worry about it. Oh, yeah, there's some worries. Because I'm coming back, and there's going to be an accounting. Does that make sense? All right, now get ready to mark some things here. At the end of verse 27, I mark that for my purpose, and so you may not want to do that. You may disagree and want to put it somewhere else. That's the end of the Perean ministry. We started in 9 and 51. If you want to go back and flag that, 9 and 51, and here we are at 19 and 27. That seems to be the end of the Perean ministry. Now, I know Baxter puts it at verse 44, but I'm not going to do that because he's seeing Jerusalem, and he's got his eyes on Jerusalem by this point at verse 41. He's already made his triumphal entry into Jerusalem. Make sense? All right. Now, let's talk about this triumphal entry into Jerusalem. That verse 29 says that when he's going up to Jerusalem, he came near Bethphage. This is from Logos Bible Software, and I like how they've kind of exploded this a little bit, where Jericho is right over here about where my circle is, and that here's the Mount of Olives, and it's thought to be Bethphage is up just a little bit. We're talking about very short distances in Bethany and Jerusalem. So you see all of those mentioned at verse 29 is they came near Bethphage and Bethany, and they came to the Mount of Olives. He sent two disciples, and by the way, he told them, go in, you're going to find this colt tied, and they're going to ask you, what's it for? And you're going to tell him this. That shows he has divine, supernatural knowledge. Does that make sense? You know, he didn't say go to a city, and if you can find a donkey or a horse or an ox, something, just something for me to ride on. No, you're going to go find this colt tied, and they're going to ask you this question. And when they got there, they found it just like he said. All right? And so they brought him in. He came in this mighty entrance into Jerusalem. Now, we've done this with Matthew and Mark. Let's do it with Luke. Flag the days if you're so disposed to do that. It helps me to put in the margin of the text, this is taking place during this week. This is what we call Passion Week. Here we are on Sunday. On Friday is his arrest and trial. He's in the tomb on Saturday, and he's raised from the dead the next Sunday, the next week, 1 week from today. That is, not 1 week from today in our study. I'm saying 1 week from the day in our text, he's going to be raised from the dead. So flag verses 28 and through verse 40 as being on Sunday. That's his triumphal entry into Jerusalem. Now let's get ahead of ourselves. unless we run out of time, we're going to come back and talk about some others, but let's flag verses 45 to 48. The cleansing of the temple is taking place on Monday, the next day. He went back out to Bethany. We'll flag that here in just a moment. Not mentioned here, but mentioned in Matthew. We'll get to that. So anyway, he made his triumphal entry into Jerusalem. And notice as he comes near Jerusalem, Luke is the only one mentions the details of this. What do we find in 41 to 44? He looks at Jerusalem and he weeps and he cries. Why? Yeah. It's over their missed opportunity. Might underline, if you had known, even you, the things which make for peace. If you would have just listened and you had known, this city could have been spared. It's too late. It's too late. If you had known the time of your visitation. So when he talks at verse 43 and 44, the enemies will build an embankment around you and they will level you and your children within you to the ground, etc., and leave not one stone upon another. He's talking about the destruction of, which took place AD 70. Yes. All right. Now let's go to the cleansing of the temple. We've got a couple of minutes to go, so let's see if we can do this. What does he do on Monday? The following day, he goes in and cleanses the temple. Is this the first time he's done this? Second time. John 2 talks about when, and as he began his ministry, he cleansed the temple. This is a different occasion. And so he drove out those who bought and sold there and said, my house is, as it is written, my house shall be called a house of prayer, but you've made it a den of thieves. And he was teaching daily in the temple. And they wanted to seize him and kill him, but why wouldn't they? Verse 48. Afraid of the people. They were attentive to him. So a crowd has gathered. You might flag this at Matthew, might make a marginal note. Matthew 21, 17 says he went back out to Bethany. Just a little walk out from Jerusalem. He went back out to Bethany for the night, and then he's ready to come back the next day. So next week, we're going to pick up at chapter 20, and we're going to be on Tuesday. That last public discourse, maybe, depends on what we do with chapter 21. Remember, we've been flagging that since Matthew, that there may be some discussion that took place on Wednesday. We'll talk about that in chapter 21. But anyway, Tuesday and Wednesday is his last public discourse, but that Tuesday is where the scathing rebuke takes place to the Jews and the announcement of the destruction of Jerusalem, etc. Make sense? Wish we had more time to do practical things, but we had two chapters to try to get through, and our time is gone. So we're going to stop right there.